From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Pablo Arauz Peña with your state and local news update. The entire Southeast Alaska Panhandle will experience very cold temperatures this week, with wind chill warnings issued for Upper Lynn Canal.
The last time Juneau hit zero was back in 2014. However, the last time we actually got below zero was back in the winter of 2009.
Cody Moore, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Juneau, says temperatures will range from 0 to 5 degrees below in Haines, Skagway, Gustavus, and Juneau. The coldest areas in Juneau will be in the Mendenhall Valley near Mendenhall Glacier.
Cold air likes to pool in valleys during the nighttime, so then having the glacier just exacerbates that. So that's why we get 10 to 15 degrees colder than the airport, which is only a few miles away.
Temperatures at the Juneau Airport are also moderated by water in Gastineau Channel. All other communities in Southeast Alaska, from Yakutat to Metlakatla and everywhere else in between, will experience temperatures down to the low teens and single digits.
It's going to last through the week. Tuesday and Wednesday are going to be the coldest days. Then we have a slight moderating trend through the weekend. However, temperatures are still expected to remain below freezing.
Winds will be gusting in White Pass north of Skagway, prompting wind chills as low as 60 below. Wind chills in downtown Juneau will be as low as 40 below.
Bundle up, dress well, and if you have to be outside, just make sure you're taking the necessary precautions for dealing with this cold weather. Just know that in as little as 30 minutes that frostbite can occur, especially when wind chills are as low as negative 25.
Moore says a high-pressure system over northwest Canada is forcing cold air to flow toward a low-pressure system in the Gulf of Alaska. He says the colder and drier conditions may be helped by a cool La Niña ocean pattern now underway in the Pacific Ocean. And in other news, the parent company of the proposed Pebble Mine says it is cooperating with a federal grand jury investigation. The company says the case relates to conversations about the mine that were secretly recorded, but who is being investigated and for what alleged crime is not clear. Alaska Public Media's Eliz Ruskin reports.
The company, British Columbia-based Northern Dynasty, issued a statement Friday that leaves a lot unanswered. It says that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Alaska issued subpoenas to Pebble Limited Partnership and its former CEO, Tom Collier, requiring them to hand over certain documents. The statement says the investigation appears related to, quote, previously disclosed recordings of private conversations regarding the Pebble project, unquote. That seems to describe the so-called Pebble tapes, undercover recordings produced last year by an environmental group. The mining company's statement doesn't say whether the investigation is aimed at the environmental group for making the tapes or whether the target might be the mine executives for what they said on those recordings. The group, called the Environmental Investigation Agency, had investigators call Northern Dynasty last year posing as foreign investors. In multiple recordings, Collier and Northern Dynasty President Ron Thiessen bragged about their close relationships to regulators and downplayed all hurdles to getting their permits. They also described plans for a much bigger mine than the one they're seeking permits for. After the recordings were made public in September, Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington called for the Justice Department to investigate Pebble for discrepancies in how Pebble described the size of the mine to Congress and in permit applications compared to what they told the men they thought were investors. The Environmental Investigation Agency declined to comment for this story. It said last fall the recordings complied with all relevant laws. Pebble and the U.S. Attorney's Office also declined to comment. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Inclusivity has always been an issue for scientific fields like paleogenomics or the study of ancient DNA. Several academic researchers who document Southeast Alaska's ancient history are highlighting the need to retain more Native researchers in a lecture series hosted by Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. I spoke to some of the researchers for this story. In 1996, the remains of a man now called Shukaka were found in a cave on Prince of Wales Island. James Dixon, anthropology professor at the University of New Mexico, was a lead researcher in that excavation. He says Shukaka, or the man ahead of us, brings to light the origins of Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people. But what set this excavation apart from others isn't just that Shukaka was found, but how the researchers treated his remains.
There were a number of meetings. People listened to each other and worked together very cooperatively throughout the excavations and subsequent analysis and then reburial of Shukaka's remains.
These types of excavations, especially when they involve the ancestors of people who live nearby, haven't always gone well. Around the same time in Washington State, the remains of the so-called Kennewick Man were found. The almost complete skeleton of an ancestor was a big deal at the time, but the way it was handled by scientists was controversial.
The Kennewick discovery was very adversarial. There was difficulty between the federal agencies involved, the scientists, and the appropriate tribal governments. And it was really quite contentious.
Dixon says, unlike the ancestor in Washington, the discovery of Shukaka was handled more respectfully by those involved in the research. He recalls the words of Clarence Jackson, an elder involved in naming Shukaka.
He believed that Shukaka came to the people of Southeast Alaska at a time when they needed him because he had a story to tell.
Rip and Molly has been working with indigenous communities in Southeast Alaska for over a decade and is currently a paleogenomics researcher in Illinois. He says the ethical questions, like the ones raised by the ancestor in Washington, highlights the need for more indigenous researchers in fields like paleogenomics.
Anthropologists in the past, as well as geneticists in the past, have approached their science in a way that was not inclusive and had colonial tendencies.
But Molly says the field has grown more collaborative in recent years.
These days, at least in publications, there's now usually a section on ethics and community engagement in the body of the paper, whereas that wouldn't have existed even over 5 years ago. So that's nice to see.
Molly is also part of an effort to bring more Native researchers to study ancient DNA, called the Summer Internship for Indigenous Peoples in Genomics, or SING. He says what's unique about the workshop is that all of the faculty involved are Indigenous researchers or work closely with Native communities. Alyssa Bader, an anthropologist who is Tsimshian, was a student in the SING Consortium studying ancient DNA of ancestors in British Columbia. Bader says that as a student with SING, she saw more indigenous scientists in one place than ever before. But there's still room for more researchers like her.
We need to include people with indigenous backgrounds and ties to indigenous communities in the work that's being done with genomics in indigenous communities now.
And what's more, Bader says that while the ethics of research is more inclusive than it once was, it's also about being welcoming.
The piece that's still growing in the academic community is not just attracting researchers with diverse backgrounds and perspectives, but also retaining them by ensuring that their perspectives are appreciated and acknowledged.
Bader says it just makes more sense to have researchers from a variety of perspectives. In Juneau, I'm Pablo Arauz Peña. And in other news, the United States and Russia have updated their plan for addressing pollutants across national boundaries in the Bering and Chukchi Seas. The agreement between the United States and Russia, known as the Joint Contingency Plan, has been in effect since 1989. The U.S. Coast Guard is the U.S. agency that does most of the work of this work, working with counterparts at Russia's Marine Rescue Service. Coast Guard Incident Management official Mark Everett says the plan lays out protocols for pollution that spreads from one nation's waters to the other.
This agreement says, essentially, we will agree to notify you. We will agree to request assistance in the response if needed.
Everett says to date there have been no joint responses to pollution like oil or marine debris along that boundary with Russia. However, he says the two entities regularly conduct exercises and share information on pollution within their boundaries.
There was one recently in Kamchatka, on the Russian side, that the Russian Federation government shared information with the United States. We offered assistance. They didn't accept the offer of assistance, but that is part of the bilateral agreement, to share information about other incidents, even though they may not affect the other party.
This is KTOO News.